Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 9th Annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organizes a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 18 writers read their stories and poems on the theme of encounters. The public reading was held on Friday, January 25th, 2019, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Here now are their writings for Writers Read, Encounters.
And our first reader is J.W. Sutton.
Good evening. Thank you, Cynthia. I'm J.W. I live in Ashland, and my piece is nonfiction. When I was 17, I was going to high adventure camp, Florida Sea Base, with my Boy Scout troop. It would be a week of diving in clear blue waters, earning our scuba certifications. We raised money for months. I studied the guidebook they had mailed us, filled out all the sample quizzes. I ate gobstoppers and spree candies until my tongue bled on the overnight drive down I-95. We never made it. Stopping for the night near Hollywood, Florida, our scoutmasters checked the weather for the coming days. Bad news. Given the imminent landfall of Hurricane Andrew, currently projected to slam into our intended destination in the Keys, Florida Sea Base was no longer safe. Our leaders presented us with two options. We could go to a hurricane shelter near the coast and work with the sea base counselors there. We'd continue with the book learning part of the certification and then head out to the Keys after it was safe. Or we could go to Disney World. Orlando was a pretty good decision, barely receiving more than a day of steady rain while the scuba camp got wiped off the island. My leaders were quite adept at organization and communication, so checking in at the Disney resort was painless. We had monorail passes, park passes, and an artificial lagoon to swim in that didn't even have alligators. Apart from the rainy first day, the weather was warm and sunny, and the parks were relatively empty since the hurricane had scared so many people away. Three things about our impromptu visit stick in my memory. The first was the owl that we saw on a golf course, and lest you mistake me for a duffer, we were not golfing. I don't remember anyone playing on the course, actually. My fellow scouts and I, in a period of unsupervised excitement, had missed our train. Not eager to miss dinner as well, we figured that the fastest way back to the hotel was to cut across the various resort areas, which included a very fancy golf course. Don't worry, we stayed off the putting greens. The walk itself took a lot longer than we were expecting, but along the way, we spotted a barred owl. It was huge and sitting on an exposed branch only like 6 feet off the ground. It was the first time I'd ever seen an owl in the wild, let alone in daylight. The second thing I recall is that being 17 really kind of stinks. One night our troop headed out to Pleasure Island, a collection of nightclubs on Disney property. No one had plans to try and drink, but we were excited about the other options available. Comedy club, an adventurers club, there was all kinds of fun to be had. But Disney is Disney, and they would not let us in unless we were 18 or had our parents with us. The last memory I have from the Magic Kingdom that year is from one of the most cliche rides in the Disney World pantheon. It's a Small World. A group of boys, all ages 15 to 17, decided that we would go on the ride accompanied by the world's most annoying song just to say that we did it. So we filed into one of the many lanes marked out by stainless steel railings and began what seemed like an interminable wait. I spent most of the time fidgeting and scanning the scores of other people in line. One group caught my eye. It was two or three women, maybe in their 20s, with at least two occupied strollers with them. They were accompanied by two guys, maybe a little older, who looked too cool to be standing in line with us. Covered in tattoos, hiding behind dark shades, one in a buzz cut, the other with very long hair. They looked like invaders from late night MTV, not tourists at one of the most saccharine attractions on the East Coast. As we waited, I couldn't shake the feeling that I'd recognize them, that they should be doing something loud and subversive. but they were quiet and patient, and they made their way through the queue just like everyone else. Although they arrived after my group, their line was faster, and they ended up a few cars ahead of us on the ride. As I watched them load into their faux boat in the faux river to watch animatronic children sing under a pink sky, I finally realized where I knew them from. I asked my friends if they recognized them. Who? I pointed them out. I said their name. Nope. No idea what you're talking about. It may be worth noting that most of my troop went to Catholic school, and they were Boy Scouts on top of that. Curiosity gnawed at me through the entire ride. When we finally got to the end, I asked my friends to wait for me, and I tore off into the crowds. I had to know. Luckily, the punks with the strollers hadn't gone far. I approached them, and as soon as I was in their line of sight, I said, quietly, "Excuse me, you guys with the Chili Peppers?" Anthony Kiedis nodded to me. Flea just kept walking. "Cool," I said. I rushed back to my troop. Turns out the ride is well named. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Crystal Gibbons, and I live in Washburn, Wisconsin. And I'll be reading two prose poems. Both are from my collection, Now, Here, Nowhere, recently published by Holy Cow Press. The first poem is titled Fish House. You sit warm in the frumpy fish house, drinking Folgers, jig the icy minnow that's below in utter dark, and wait for a walleye to bite the hook. You peer through tiny windows, not a tree in sight. Snow is everywhere, and you almost forget about darkness. There is not enough snow in this world, you think, but it's getting late. You must gather your line and turn back. You step outside and glide across black ice toward home. For a moment, you don't feel anything at all beneath your feet until the ice slips under you. You hear a faint crackling. The lake opens, surges, recedes. You think of the newcomers and a few locals who vanished forever beneath the ice. You remember how the cold, hard mouth of the world yawned and swallowed entire pickups, plows, fish houses. Nothing exists except terror and the void. No matter how many times you've lived this before, you fear you are doomed. Water bubbles up. You must be careful where you step, for the ground doesn't crumble, but turns slushy, ominously spongy. You exhale the ancient chill. You find a toehold and continue crossing little slopes of snow. The next poem I'll read is titled Night Pals. Where do they go when they're not mixing drinks, trading stories, telling jokes, and getting the jukebox going when the place turns dead? You've heard rumors about bartenders, how they've been around, how they throw wild after-bar parties, how they have lots of affairs. Sitting on a red bar stool, eating stale popcorn, you start to imagine that he could be your friend or lover. Then one night, without warning, he is gone, been replaced by another bartender named John, who's then replaced by, what's his name again? You can't remember, but he looks handsome in that sort of rugged, sensitive way. You keep coming back to the bar with its ripped vinyl seats, windows brimmed with thick curtains, Pabst Blue Ribbon sign glowing a golden mug, and the magnet on the stainless steel fridge reads, "Beer is proof that God wants us to be happy." You could live in this bar forever. You feel sexy drinking the little bit of beer from the bottom of the glass. You begin telling the bartender another story, and he listens as if it's the first time he's heard it. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Riley Kaiser. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, And while my piece doesn't have the Red Hot Chili Peppers, I am proud to bring you the spice of the night. My piece is titled River Gifts. It's nonfiction. Technically, this isn't trespassing, as long as we stay in the boat, Rose says from the prow of our inflatable kayak. We're paddling upstream along the River Avon, flanked by either side by willow and hawthorn trees that hide the Malmesbury Abbey from our prying eyes. The first king of England lay buried within the abbot's garden, where he competed for attention with local celebrity Hannah Tuoni, the first woman in Britain to be mauled to death by a tiger. It's a Tuesday in the last week of June. We are indulging in a decadent afternoon off. Rose hangs her bare feet over the edge of the kayak, chain smoking. I can still taste the sugar on the back of my throat from wolfing down two chocolate ice cream bars. The fact that we are here relaxing and not hard at work at Rose's farm feels far more criminal than our lawfully ambiguous choice of recreation. We are here on the River Avon to escape the slow death of crops awaiting back at the farm. It has not rained once in the 3 weeks that I have been volunteering with Rose. The air has become so dry that there's no morning dew, and the few clouds that we see roll by quickly onto more important things. At first, I had teased her, accusing her and her countrymen of lying about their rainy weather, but the jokes lost its humor as the soil cracks. Infant seedlings wither and die in a single afternoon while their slightly older siblings starve in holding containers. The plants that have made it into the ground get sunburned and sickly as the soil degrades, losing the ability to sustain life. Our time is consumed with watering everything by hand. The farm is not outfitted with much in the way of irrigation. Rose has carefully arranged her fields and greenhouses to minimize the effects of flooding, not drought. Her foresight was indispensable for the spring. The three preceding months had brought over twice the average rainfall. Already, there is no way for her to break even this year, and the summer's just barely begun. The only solace comes at night. We weed carrots by moonlight, switch sprinklers from the corn to the squash, stepping over the corpses of the plants we could not save. Industrial wheat combines growl along the other side of hedgerows, while multi-million-dollar racehorses doze in the neighboring fields. Black helicopters bear members of the royal family to their nearby estate and ferry the CEO of the Dyson Vacuum Company from his headquarters to London. Feudalism has never died here. The smoke from Rose's cigarettes lounges in the thick summer air, curling lazily around us. We pass by ornamental shrubs that I do not recognize, their slender forms and strange leaves as foreign to me as everyone's accent. A family of swans hisses at us when we get too close to their babies. The bells of the monastery toll softly in the background. It's hard not to fall in love with this place. In the distance, I see something pale floating languidly in the water. The English litter just as much as the Americans, much to my disappointment. Instinctively, I reach out to grab it, my hands curling around something firm and smooth. For half a second, I wonder if I'm still dreaming. We're still back at the farm, hallucinating while I work. In my loud, gleeful Midwestern voice, I cry out, "Look at this!" Rose turns around. "What is that?" I hold my precious discovery in the air, water dripping from the tender white silicone. The couple sitting on a bench nearby cackle as they recognize it. I've shocked them out of their British stoicism. "It's a dildo!" Rose shrieks, "Put it back!" Ow! What? It's litter! The dildo bounces against the floor of the inflatable kayak when I drop it in. Rose half reaches for it, but she's afraid to touch it. I don't care. Put it back. No! The universe gave this to me. Then give it back. What's wrong? I thought you partied in Amsterdam, Rose. Didn't you do that when you were young? Don't stress me out on my afternoon off. Rose kicks water at me and the unwelcome guest in our kayak. All four of us are laughing. Rose and I in our kayak in the middle of this historic dildo-laden river. And the couple on the bench trying to enjoy their romantic getaway. This is it. This is the most precious thing I can offer my friend. Temporary reprieve from the drought, the debt, the noose tightening around small farmers in an era of climate change and monopolized industrial farming, strangling the few people who have any ties left to the land whatsoever, in a world obsessed with convenience and money. This is what I'll remember for the rest of my time at her farm, as the drought worsens and Rose's water bills threaten to drown her. I will stare up at the dusty, carbon-sick sky and remember my mirthful delight as I threw the dildo back into the river where it floated in the water, loyally waiting for me to pick it up an hour later when we paddled back downstream. That's where my story ends. But that's not where the drought ended. It didn't lift until September, and I haven't heard from my friend Rose since August. I am sharing this with you because I need your help. I don't know what the next decade is going to look like, but I know it will require all of our love, our attention, our bravery, and our sense of humor. And I want to invite you with open arms. Please, this world is worth saving, and I want to be able to share this very silly story with my children in a world where rivers still exist, and hopefully dildos too. Thank you.
You've been listening to Writers Read, Encounters, a collection of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry read by writers before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 9th Annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organizes a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 18 writers read their stories and poems on the theme of encounters. The public reading was held on Friday, January 25th, 2019, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Here now are their writings for Writers Read, Encounters.
My name is Tara Wisniewski-Janish, and I'm from Washburn. I'll be reading a poem tonight. Like a Virgin. It's 1989, and the Berlin Wall has fallen. Civil unions are legal in Denmark, and we just invaded Panama under the guise of overthrowing Manuel Noriega, and the brothers Mendez have murdered their parents. At least the Dalai Lama has won the Nobel Peace Prize. The world is confusing. It's 1989 and I'm barely 14 when a guy named Gary tells me, "Don't be such a baby," as he pulls me in front of him to hide his erection and sticks his hands down my pants and basketballs pound on the gymnasium floor and winter's wet weather blows through the door. I was just waiting for my dad. The world is confusing and I'm confused because, you know, Gary's a nice guy. He's funny and everyone's friend. My friend tells me so, gushes. She's an upperclassman. She must know. But the world is confusing because sex is a sin. The Catholics tell me don't be such a whore. But Madonna preaches sexuality and like a virgin echoes in my ears and my heart pounds against my rib cage and no one knows what he did to me. This must be what a whore is. The world is confusing. You can't import assault weapons. Bundy has been executed, and yet an 18-year-old is allowed to assault me, a child. Except I don't know what assault means, but I do know that the Catholic high school won't protect me, and I'm confused because he tells me it's okay. He's allowed to do this, and don't be such a baby. And the Catholics call me a whore. I'm confused because no one ever told me everyone's friend has this right, but I'm not certain he is my friend. I don't want to be a whore. I didn't let this happen. But who will believe me? He's older and knows the world is confusing. And I'm confused as I shrink within myself, twisting to hide my woman's breasts and squeeze my legs together, silently screaming, "Keep out." I sit on my bedroom floor, a teenage girl alone, hiding in my secret shame while I cut my legs until they bleed out this pain, this I don't understand. And when I am 40, I know exactly what this is. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Sheila Paca. I'm from Duluth, via the Iron Range in Minnesota. And these are prose poems. Soliloquy. My grandmother poured a shot of brandy into her coffee. Punna, she called it. She kept the liquor bottle in the kitchen cabinet, top shelf, on the Iron Range. My grandfather was already gone in several directions. They were first-generation immigrants. Years later, I learned punna meant red. I learned the word for river, the kind that one can't step into twice. A photo in black and white, my grandmother in a house dress outside, drinking beer with my uncles, a case of beer. She always wore an apron and black shoes with thick heels and thin laces, and she spoke rivers in Finnish. The pendulum clock knocked in the night and struck the hours with small bells. The chrome kitchen table and yellow naga hide chairs were listening. Her living room was pale green and the carpet deep green. On the wall, a pastoral, cows heading toward a barn and a horse-drawn wagon on a road never arriving. Nearby were silhouettes framed and a family portrait with my grandfather at the center passed out near a kerosene stove below the ceiling vent, a television connected to an antenna, behind its convex screen, interference. When my mother was small, there were 10 children in a two-bedroom house. Too many mouths, not enough hands. Shadows had a long reach. In the hallway, a Singer sewing machine, a pincushion, a basket of unfinished business, wool scraps to make a weighty blanket for the bed. "Don't think about the past," my mother said. But I was not released. In the kitchen, she stood at a porcelain sink with cold water only. It drained into a slop bucket. One must remember to take the bucket out to wind the clock and keep the pantry door open so it wouldn't freeze, to leave things out. No doors inside the house, just curtains with cabbage roses. Outside the window, a view of clotheslines. In Toivola, the place that meant beautiful, she had an outhouse, a swamp full of tadpoles and horseflies. Inside, a record player, a stack of 78s and 45s. Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Patsy Cline. All the children left home early. Crickets, grasshoppers, cats. The hay slid into the stalls and hooves knocked on the barn floor. I saw tails tied up with binder twine, brown bottles of beer. In the other language over my head, I stepped into the drop-off and couldn't swim. Nights of lighted tobacco smoke and accordions on the instruments, bellow clips and register switches, inside, reeds and wax, outside, push and pull. I realized the way my eyes deceive me. I went back and walked on the same ground, looked into the other country, the places where my grandmother left. Why did she want to go? Why did she stay? I heard hands playing the instruments and the sound of falling water, the swish of skirts over secrets, the feet that said forget, and the heels that said don't mention it. This poem is called In the Water-Filled Mine Pit. In the boat, on the water, I slide over her body, the excavation. She is slag. She is crushed stone, unburied. I am over her bones, geologic, Mesabi iron. I drift over knee and shin and float over her shattered self, heaped upon the earth, over boulders submerged. Veins were broken open, emptied, and made into freight. A cold current from the drift presses against the chamber. The bow lifts. She is bedrock, the bottom of the continent, and through her runs dark and invisible rivers without shore. She is the divide. In the seams of the tectonic plates, she is lit with dynamite and extracted mined, carried by trains to the ships. I see a shoulder of iron in place of her head, a deep shaft. Remade, she becomes steel, becomes bridge, becomes beam, ship and tank and weapon. At the end, junk in the junkyards, rusting into the weeds. The vessel turns like the needle of a compass broken from its post. I hear the tail splash of a trout. The fish spiral along the perimeter inside the pit on the winding road once traveled in shifts by men in hard hats, in old dump trucks and steam shovels. The trout tend the broken cables, skeletal and rusted frames. Surface tensions. A fence cannot hold back the danger. The water has risen. The engineers call it water gain. Precipitation, surface water inflow, a rise in the water table, a threat against the walls of the pit. Light falls, but can't find bottom 300 feet below. Circles tumble and bend beneath the water's surface. I hear the gravel sliding in. I hear insects and birds' wings over the factory of the deep. The water ends with a line, no wide strip of shore for landing. Stained with ore, the water feels like ice. It magnifies the hand that I plunge beneath the surface. It breaks the lines of my body, her body. The vessel falls upward. The ore could condense into the red mist of atoms. I break the surface and sink. I break the surface and rise. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dylan Couch. I live in Washburn, and I'm reading fiction tonight. He knelt in the snow and studied the tracks. The size of hoof prints, their orientation, and the depth of depression left behind told the man a lot about the doe. He saw stained every now and then against the white, blanketed landscape, and at the base of nearby birches, drops of blood. And after pressing the palm of one hand into the snow, and with a finger testing the structure of its edge, and then the edge of a print, he reckoned the doe had run by this way only minutes ago at a speed which indicated it was fast approaching death. Standing now, he eyed the direction of the trail. The deer may already be dead. Through openings of light left between the trees in the distance, the man saw his farm fields, and he headed towards them following the trail. the snow forgiving and silent beneath his feet, melding his own tracks over those of the hunted, and in this way he labored slowly onward. The man knew the country surrounding. Deer moved against the wind in the evenings, coming out of the heavy brush to stand at the edge of fields and nibble corn stalks. He knew they followed ridgelines and ravines, natural ebbs and flows in the landscape. The land he hunted was the same which bore generations of his family name. It had belonged to his heritage for over 200 years, from the time his great-great-grandfather, a Polish immigrant upon a merchant ship arriving in the land of the free, eventually walked his way to Wisconsin. Were he alive, that fearless pioneer who shared in his blood would understand nothing of the burdens the man now faced. His crops had failed the past 5 years due to flooding. He had had to sell parcels of the once vast territory acquired at that time, predating modern industry, when all that was needed to survive off the land was to farm it, and at a time, too, when land ownership was a direct measurement of a person's worth. Of those 300 acres, the man now owned only 20 himself. The land surrounds, encroaches him as a proverbial reminder, woe to the conquered. Arriving at the wood edge, he saw the tracks move across the field and against the wind. Moving also against the wind were the wolves. They came as gray shadows across the white open field, loping, running bold and soundless and without a trace on top the wind-blown snow crust. One detached itself from the others and slowed, seeing the man. The man tightened his grip on the rifle slung to his shoulder, knowing well he would not have need to use it, but holding it nonetheless because he was scared and because the reassurance of the steel in his hands made him less so. The wolf came to a stop and observed him. The man saw the wolf plain as the day. He could see its eyes and the steam as it tested the air with its snout. He looked at the wolf and understood that it also projected on the landscape certain notions of ownership. The strength and longevity of a pack relates to its ability to maintain, perhaps even grow, its territory. The man considered these things. He wondered how a wolf might handle his own diminished standing. He thought it might join a larger pack to ensure its survival, and by this thread, the man confirmed the wolf was free in a way the man was not, he who was constrained to what little he had before him. The wolf stood attentive and straight with its ears perked. Mostly, it looked at him. Sometimes it looked at the direction its pack ran, but always it turned back to look at him. The man knew in his heart the wolf was at home and he was a stranger in his own field. With this thought in mind, he imagined into a picture a world wherein he, like the wolf, was able to move across the landscape stalking prey without giving mind to all the restraints society imposed on him. But in that world, he did not exist. Wolf and man regarded each other one last time, with a detached and cool acknowledgement that the other is different, before the animal turned to run after its kin, who were now circling in on the dead doe lying in a ditch on that side of the road the man no longer owned. Thank you.
You've been listening to Writers Read Encounters, a collection of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry read by writers before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 9th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organizes a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 18 writers read their stories and poems on the theme of encounters. The public reading was held on Friday, January 25th, 2019, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Some content may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Here now are their writings for Writers Read Encounters.
Hi, I'm Angie Mason. I'm from Duluth. I'll be reading three poems. Callisto and Her Reflection. It's taking time for her to acclimate. She moves fawn-like toward the ice. Her body once an astrum of stars, circumpolar and spinning. She heads down the center of the road, past Gypsy's Bakery, past the Anglican Church. She rubs her back on a truck, then heads towards the bay. It's during these cool hours, when glaciers build, then fall, and ice floes drift like Arctic lilies, that she moves like a thick ghost across Hudson. She stalks the scent of ringed seal breath and moves clockwise around breathing holes. She waits for the seal's lungs to slowly lose air till they float like black balloons to the surface. Snow geese, Arctic terns, keep their distance. Pool of sky spilled out between them, level with the night. Her mouth open like a kiss with the sky. What great relief, or possibly grief, they now have shared. She wonders if forgiveness is still an option. The Bowerbird. The woman is painting screws and clothespins blue. With a mallet, she breaks blue glass bottles beneath the pockets of her apron. She gathers clusters of butterfly pea flowers and dried blue fruit, scatters them throughout the yard. At the edge of her property, the Bowerbird, with his black and blue plumage, steals anything blue his beak can carry. Blue shells, pen caps, blue beetle wings. He ranges them in piles at the threshold of his nest, decorating a blue stage for his mate. The woman hopes above all she'll be there when the pale green female is seduced. She's cleared her calendar for the duration and sleeps with binoculars around her neck. The Bowerbird watches the woman's hands, waiting for blue to fall, marbles, turquoise rings. He once caught a glimpse of vein in her wrist, thought about unraveling it, pecking it straight through, curious as she is, still feel love. Copper Bar, Price Tower. She can't say what she kept or what she remembers leaving in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. It could have been 5 sounds or the color red, or just a film of hotel soap on her skin. She thinks she remembers someone isosceles shaped with 2 equal legs. But she doesn't remember if the person was wearing a dress or undressed. She insists that there was an algorithm to the night, that there was architecture to her thoughts, that her actions were wildly ordinary. But that, of course, would be a lie. On the 15th floor of Wright's only skyscraper, she consumed beautiful Red Bell cocktails. She listened to jazz. In parallel to where she herself was sitting, she told someone, "Falling water can be defined as a series of strong horizontal and vertical lines," and that she often imagined occupying falling water. Like calculus is the study of change and geometry shape, that night she came to think in numbers and angles, and Oklahoma was a vertex where 2 lines met. It was something reached in a fever dream, less than a state, more than a state of mind. Thanks.
Good evening. My name is Ella Shively. I'm from La Crosse, Wisconsin, but I live here on campus. And I will be reading a piece of fiction called The Forecast. Juliana was in the window when they came. It was the wind that started it all, the wind that made her run up 6 flights of stairs to throw open her apartment window and listen to the howling through the screen. The wind had a voice here in the north. It really did. It shushed its way through the pines. It groaned in the branches of the dead and dying oaks. It hissed like a stray cat when it came scraping across the jagged surface of the lake. Here, in the final room on the topmost floor, she often woke to the sound of its shrieking, as though it had rounded the corner too fast and cut itself on the edge of the building. Amateur storm chaser that she was, the noise never bothered her. She'd spent many a dark and stormy night crouched in the alcove of the large bay window, watching the battling elements with cat-like focus. All the thunder and all the lightning in the heavens could not frighten her. But the wind that night promised a storm like none she had ever witnessed. That night, the wind had many voices all at once, a veritable witch's chorus. The trees lashed madly in its grasp, their shadows swooping and diving like fallen angels in the saffron glow of the street lamps. The clouds, heavy with the impending blizzard, obscured any star that might have dared to show its face. From far away came the raspy scream of a snowy owl. How would it feel to be a bird in a tree on a night like tonight? Juliana wondered, and she climbed onto the windowsill to find out. The wind shrieked louder, drowning out the cries of the owl and biting Juliana's bare cheeks through the screen. She hunkered down into her coat, opened a notebook to record her meteorological observations, and waited. The screen bowed against the force of the wind, and the apartment door rattled as though it were trying to escape. The snowy owl screamed again, but no, that wasn't right. An owl didn't sound like the grating scrape of claws on ice. A flash of white flickered in her peripheral vision. Snow? She pressed her hands against the screen to look. The corner flapped momentarily in the gale, and then the entire flimsy screen tore loose and soared into the storm. Too late, she reached after it, her outstretched arm lingering in the empty space where the screen had been. So gently, her numb fingers might not have noticed, a smooth, scaly body slithered beneath her hand. Juliana yanked her arm back and peered over the edge of the windowsill. There they were, five of the creatures, hoarfrost on their breath and icicles dangling from the points of their fangs. Lion-sized and with claws to match, they swooped effortlessly through the sky like alabaster kites, their frosted wings carrying them farther and farther into the north. Behind them, the sky became frenzied with the silent chatter of snowflakes. Out in the open air, the pages of Juliana's notebook threatened to break free and join the tempest. She gripped them tightly with one hand and made a short record of her observations with the other. January 25th, 2019. Winds out of the northeast, temperatures dropping steadily. 99% chance of blizzard conditions. 100% chance of dragons.
I'm Joel Glickman from Ashland. It was great fun matching poems to this year's theme of encounters, and I'll be reading three poems tonight that relate to it. The first of these is called Stump Grinder. The encounter, which I imagined last fall, is between a stump grinder and the remnants of a tree, but the tree does all the talking. It begins with an epigraph, a quote from a very famous poem by a very short-lived poet. Stump Grinder. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. Joyce Kilmer, 1886 to 1918. Yes, all right, above the ground I'm dead or dying, so you can cart off what you've brought down with that cracking sound, crisp as an autumn day. And when that's done, bring your machine and chip away till all that's left, once every little woody shred's been raked up, is a scar shaped like a circle, and you can green that up with grass seed if you like. But we're not dead down here, yes, out of mind and out of sight, just until I send up suckers, sucker, and you can kill my babies as they rise, and I'll keep sending them forever. Meanwhile, as concerns my restless little fingers, not one among them lingers in one place for very long. You can count on kinky sex as they tangle with the and breach your sewer lines on their way to Canada, beneath the bay, and southward down to Madison, which incidentally doesn't give a shit about what happens this far north. And while I have no axe to grind with Michigan or Minnesota, there is no quota on routing routes or miles logged underground, no weigh-in stations, so ever on and outward press my sneaky little minions, my lovely all-day, all-night truckers. And we don't like that buzzy sound you mothers make, but go ahead. Knock yourself out, son. Chip away. We own the earth. You may have the lush and deep green lawn, the blue October sky, and soon you will be gone. I'm sorry, I need to explain. I have been writing poems since grade 4, 5, or 6 at the latest, but shortly after that, grade 7, I started playing clarinet because my mother made me, and I have been doing that ever since as well. I tell you this because this next poem of encounter embraces both the musician in me and the writer. It is, on one level, about the interaction of a clarinetist and a saraband by J.S. Bach, and on another, but metaphorically only, a sexual encounter. So this is called Friday Night with Saraband, Shacked Up in the Suite of Dances. She stares back at me from where she's sitting on my music stand, all dressed up in a fancy and expensive French edition. She is petite, takes up only half a page, and waits for me to get my horn out. Equal parts amused, flirtatious, prim. I'm intrigued by her and also nervous. She comes with a pedigree, Bach BWV 1007, Suite 2, in binary. Another lovely orphan child of old J.S., 300 years adrift and counting in the foster system, bouncing around for centuries from transcription to transcription, which is where I found her, and before whom I now flounder. And so she grows impatient and speaks first, a little playfully, but also terse. Oh my God, another clarinet player. Hardly the answer to my every prayer, but you seem like a nice fellow. Look, please try to play me dark and mellow, more like I would be sung upon the cello, Papa's original intent. Besides, he himself did rearrangements too. They sold well and helped to pay the rent, but please, no jazz, no razzmatazz, no cheesy forced vibrato, no short staccato. Okay, that's good, but slow it down. I am a saraband and not a jig. I could never figure out why men in general, and reed men in particular, are creatures of such haste. All right, but not that much. I'm stately, but not churchy, and not chaste. Just stay within the bounds of taste, and you'll be fine. Later, as I do not smoke tobacco, I sip a glass of wine and sit with her a while. She still has that overtone of laughter in her smile. She says, not bad. By far, you're not the worst I've had. I once was ravished by a vaudevillian who played the saw, which bent my lovely spine every imaginable way. It still hurts on a rainy day. I'd as soon be violated by a piper, hurdy-gurdist, or pit viper. I take this as a compliment and put away my instrument. But hear distinctly old Bach chuckling in the firmament above my head. Thank you. This last poem is about the meeting at their juncture of two seasons, late summer and early autumn. There are four stanzas, and each one is a different scene in a different place. It's called Four Exits for September, and it also has an epigraph, a short quote from a beautiful old song, which is a favorite of mine. So going against my better judgment, I will sing rather than speak the epigraph. This is called Four Exits for September. Four Exits for September. And these few precious days I'll spend with you. These precious days I'd spend with you. September song, Kurt Vile. September was arraigned today in Cleveland, facing charges of collusion with late August, trafficking in tsunami, and suborning hurricane, and was led from the courthouse in handcuffs, head bowed and covered with his jacket, so October had to hold him firmly by one arm and steer him through the mob and the reporters. September stood beaming on the platform, which had been put up on Marienplatz at dawn. The sun shone brightly on Bavaria and warmed the town of Munich. He wore his best suit, topped with a new, somewhat incongruous, feathered Tyrolean hat, said a few cheerful words, handed off the ceremonial key of the city to October, likewise smiling, and then a mug of hoppy German beer, to much applause both of them savoring the frothy and gemütlich moment, while several skilled pickpockets worked the crowd. September doubled over, rode the back of stumbling October as he struggled through the surf at Folly Beach, and once ashore, laid the old month shocky and half conscious on the sand, and did what he could to staunch the gaping wound. But he bled out just as the Charleston paramedics came on sight and the caution, do not swim signs were all put up again. September stood sentry at a Buckingham entry, eyes forward and stock still, looking most impressive in red tunic and jet black bearskin hat. At 11 sharp, October, by tradition, in a dance done with precision, stepped up to take his place. They looked almost like twins, although October's uniform fit him a bit more snugly. And there was this. In the instant before he pivoted and went on his martial way, September winked at him. But no spectator saw that, except me. Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to Writers Read Encounters, a collection of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry read by writers before a live audience. The event is produced by Northland College in Ashland in collaboration with Wisconsin Public Radio. Many thanks to our partners, the judges and writers Kyle Anholt, Dylan Couch, Sean Devlin, Carol Dunbar, Crystal Gibbons, Joel Glickman, Riley Kaiser, Grace Kilbane, Angie Mason, Lori Otis, Sheila Paca, Sue Schreiner, Ella Shively, J.W. Sutton, Tara Wisniewski-Janish, Devin Levy, Gina Kirsten, and Julie Buckles. I'm Danielle Kading. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.